All right, welcome to the 7500 to Holt podcast. My name is Gareth Simpson, and with me is Robert Lintott.
Howdy, everyone.
We're a bit more ramshackle than usual this week. It's just Robert and I for the time being, and if Aaron and Andrew show up, we'll add them as it goes, and because I have a very important concert to go to tonight, I may well drop out, and Robert will grab the reins, and, you know, it's all very fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants over here at 7500 to Holt. But we might as well start off with a discussion of our match against Swansea. Of course, that was a pretty drab game, but it was overshadowed by, I mean, some understandably tragic events. And so, I mean, in light of that, Robert, why don't you talk about, you know, what you thought about the game?
Well, it was kind of interesting because I thought it started at, an actual, like, on the hour time. So I came in about 15 minutes late. And missed all of the Gary Speed stuff at the beginning. Had no idea what anyone was talking about. So I was kind of puzzled by how everyone is sort of down about this. But, I mean, we have to address what a horrible way to, you know, what a horrible conditions and time to play a match under.
Well, absolutely. And, I mean, when you consider there were so many players on both sides. And, I mean, for God's sakes, it was a match in Wales. Everyone was completely shaken up by it. And it was, you know, it was really stunning because I mean, when I woke up, it was, you know, 5:30 out here, and I rolled over and I checked my Twitter account, and you could literally see the moment where everyone found out, and it, like the timeline shuddered. It was really absolutely stunning, and you know, Aaron talked about in his match report about Shay Given, who played with Gary Speed at Newcastle, having to replace his contacts because he had been crying so much, and it's, I mean, I guess. You almost don't want to talk about the match because it almost seems disrespectful, and particularly because the match wasn't very good. But I think it's understandable that, I mean, a lot of the players didn't seem to be all the way there. And so it was a very, I mean, not a whole lot happened. And I don't know if there's a whole lot we can take from it, right?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the actual match, it was... There were some bright spots. I didn't share as optimistic of a view as Aaron had of it in his write-up. And I understand there were mitigating factors that meant people weren't maybe playing totally mentally there, but it seemed match-wise to be a lot of the same old boring Villa who had trouble stringing anything together for the most part. And it wasn't really all that encouraging in my mind.
I think we probably got the better of the chances for the most part, but it was definitely Swansea that was in control. I think they outplayed us. And I think that's partly because they do play in a different style. They play in a very possession heavy style. And so, I mean, in every match we've played, I don't think we've controlled the balance of the possession in any of them. But in this match in particular, it was really obvious that they were going to have the ball and we were going to let them have it. But
yeah, it was, I mean, I think it was over at Aston Villa Central. I think Dan was talking about the number of passes, or on his Twitter feed, because I can't find it on his site, but the number of passes, and it was something like a 2.5 to 1, so what would that be, 5 to 2 ratio, with Swansea attempting more passes than we did, and just by an absurd ratio. And yet you're right. I think especially in the second half, it felt like Villa had far better chances.
Well, I mean, possession stats only go so far. They're not necessarily an objective, you know, qualitative metric. Like, you can win a game and have 30% possession. I mean, that's a couple of years. That's Mourinho's strategy against Barcelona, is that he cedes possession and defends resolutely. The problem is that we very much do not have a Mourinho caliber back line. And so, to be fair, Swansea doesn't have a Barcelona-caliber squad, but we're dealing in relatives. But I feel like this is part and parcel with the McLeish approach. It's we're not interested in, you know, in possession football. We're interested in creating chances quickly, and that's why Aguanalor is basically optimized for McLeish's approach, and someone like Darren Bent isn't necessarily. Although I don't think Darren Bent is. Particularly profits from possession heavy football. He's a poacher, and so he'll just grab whatever. But I don't know. I mean, we played our style reasonably well, and, you know, there are worse things. I think I said this in the power rankings over on over on the main page. There are worse things in the world than getting a point away in Wales, seeing as the only team that actually has beaten Swansea at the Liberty Stadium so far was Manchester United, and we are emphatically not them.
Yeah, but one of the things you said really struck me, the fact that, and you're right, McLeish likes this, create opportunities and don't worry about possession sort of a thing. Which seems to me like if you would come into the year and said, what sort of football should Villa play? I would have said counterattacking football. Something mm-hmm. that's not possession-based, create quick opportunities. And yet it doesn't feel right watching it. Maybe it's the personnel he has out there. Maybe it's they're not actually doing what he wants. But something about it just, in theory, he's doing exactly what I would have wanted. But in mm-hmm. when you see it in practice, it's nothing like what I would have wanted.
Well, I think a lot of it, I mean, you hit the nail on the head with personnel, because I think years past when we played counterattacking football, we've had Ashley Young, Stuart Downing, even Mark Albrighton more recently, just pacey wingers. And Agbonlahor is basically only, especially considering Nzagbia doesn't play very often, Agbonlahor is really the only pacey forward we have. I mean, Heskey's not going to do any running. And if you're going to play a counterattacking style with Emil Heskey on the wings, what do you think you're doing? He can hold the ball up. And I would almost prefer, if that's your ideal scenario, put Darren Bent on the bench and put Heskey up front to hold it up, because he does that well. But I don't think you can justify not starting Darren Bent. I mean, when you consider what the club paid for him and, his status as a international class, scorer of goals, I don't think McLeish could afford to sit him, because for all the pressure he gets from the fans about playing defensive football and, all the pressure he gets, whether we like it or not, for just having managed Birmingham at one point in his life, I would imagine that he would get like a much more pressure from management, from the people who actually count, if he creates habits of benching the players they shell out £24 million on.
Yeah, and I don't know, I've been kind of intrigued lately thinking of Bent, of the backlash against him. And it's not really against him, it's just more of a matter I've seen sort of from a small percentage, but from a kind of vocal amount of Villa fans saying, maybe we get rid of Bent because he doesn't really fit the system. And you can play Heskey up in that spot, but the way he's played this year, I can't see Heskey doing anything well that Bent can't do well as well. The only difference I see between the two is the price tag.
Well, I mean, that's part of it. And I think that, like it or not, Darren Bent does have a bit of a reputation now as someone who will, if he's not up for it, he'll give you a lot of stress. And I think there's two schools of thought here: is do you build your squad, your starting 11 around the approach the manager wants to take, or does the manager build the approach around his players? Because I don't think there's any question that Darren Bent is the highest quality player on Villa's books right now. And so I think, in essence, the problem lies with McLeish, is that he has to construct an approach that optimizes Darren Bent's skills, even if potentially that doesn't necessarily, that's marginally worse for, the squad as a whole, because I think he's got a responsibility, whether we like it or not, to keep Darren Bent happy. But I think at the point we're at now, at the style that McLeish wants to play, no, I don't think Darren Bent is suited for that. I think Emil Heskey, for all we slag him off, he is a physical presence who can hold up the ball a lot better than Darren Bent. Darren Bent doesn't have a whole lot in the way of control. He doesn't have a whole lot in the way of physicality. He poaches goals, and that's all he does. And it's something he does remarkably well. But if you're wanting, a target, like a target man central forward in the like Bobby Zamora mold, Heskey's a lot more suited to that role than Darren Bent is.
Yeah, I suppose that makes some sense. And like I mentioned at the tail end there is a difference in price tag. If you get rid of Bent, he's in this season, in this system, he's effectively as useless as Heskey has been. So
yes.
get rid of one of the two of them because you have two useless players with the way we're playing and, you know, maybe save a lot of money. Yeah, I can see why people would want to say, okay, maybe it's time to part ways with Bent. Do you think there's any chance we get a good return on him?
I don't think there's a chance. I don't think there's a shadow of a chance that we're going to get anywhere near what we paid for him, even though he's been a relative success. Like, he hasn't, you know, bottomed out like the other forwards that notably changed clubs at the same time he did. Like, Andy Carroll and Fernando Torres will not ever net a return that's comparable to what their clubs paid for them. But I think, especially now that we've got, you know, almost a year's worth of hindsight, it becomes ever more clear that we paid over the odds for Darren Bent because we were just desperate for someone, for someone to score goals, because we desperately lacked goals. And it's become more and more clear that he wasn't necessarily the right purchase. I mean, we've got other forwards, and even though Heskey will almost certainly move on at the end of the season, we've got Delfonso coming up, and it's an odd fit. And I think, you know, it's always kind of felt like an odd fit with Bent, but now more than ever, I genuinely don't really know why he's here.
I mostly agree with that, although I would quibble with, I still think it was the right purchase as of last year with the system we had last year.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I do agree with that.
Yeah. In retrospect, it looks like maybe it wasn't a great decision, but had we stuck with Houllier, had we stuck with his system, Bent looked incredible last season.
I think more importantly than Houllier, if we'd stuck with Young and Downing, and there's a reason that Darren Bent was talking about how absolutely gutted he was to see Young and Downing go, that's because he saw basically half of his goal total go, because that's who was creating his chances.
Yeah, and the prior to death Mark Albrighton.
But even Albrighton is not, he's not a winger of the caliber of Young and Downing. Those are essentially two of England's best wingers.
That's true. Although you want to talk about people who have bottomed out since they left the club, Stuart Downing.
He is not, what was the stat? He has not scored or even created a goal since he left.
I'm so perplexed by it. how has he turned to crap?
I don't know what it is, because he's so obviously a quality player, and he's played well for England. I think it's important to stipulate that in the international fixtures in which he's played well, but he hasn't performed for his club. And I think, you know, not to speculate on another club's, you know, tactical approach or anything like that, because I haven't seen near enough of Liverpool to really justify this sort of amateur, tactician stuff. But I get the impression that Downing was bought for Andy Carroll, and now that Andy Carroll is, you know, underperforming, Stuart Downing isn't really, like, I don't think Stuart Downing and Luis Suarez were meant for each other.
Yeah, it hasn't seemed to be a good fit at all, and you have to wonder a little bit if Downing is kind of wishing he had stayed at Villa.
I don't know if he would think that. I think in retrospect now, though, I think getting £20 million or whatever we got for him was kind of a steal, because it's playing out that, you know, those last few months of the last season, that may be the best he ever plays.
Which is I want to say it's a shame, because I really like Stuart Downing, but after what he did to us, it doesn't make me too upset to see him sucking at Liverpool.
I think there's three players who notably left us for bigger clubs over the last couple of years, he's the one that I'm able to feel the most schadenfreude towards, because it genuinely, I think the way he handled it was very, very poor. Well, I suppose more accurately, the way his agent handled it was very poor, especially when you take into account the amount of time he spent collecting paychecks while he was injured before he ever appeared for the club. But, you know, that's old news.
Yeah, it's true. So was there anything, I don't know, we can break it down. Was there anything really good that you took away from Swansea?
I mean, no, good is such a strong word when we're talking about Aston Villa.
Anything positive?
Well, I think, see, the thing is that I want to say that certain players played well when they didn't, you know, stand out as terrible. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's, And like Alan Hutton is terrible. And so that almost makes me want to say, like, for example, Chris Hurd, who is not terrible, but not particularly good, you kind of feel like you have to say, oh, Chris Hurd was good, because in comparison, he was magnificent. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, like, I think Shea Given played well, especially when you consider the circumstances. And he has been, I feel like we don't talk about it enough. He's been an absolute rock. He's been a really effective replacement for Brad Friedel. And that's someone who I thought we couldn't possibly replace. I think he's genuinely one of the best goalkeepers in the league, and I think we're seeing that play out in his time at Spurs. But so I think, you know, give Shea Given some credit. Certainly don't take him for granted. And I mean, Bonlahor had a chance or two. That's not bad.
As much as I want to slag the defense because they're a bunch of idiots and whatnot, and Given did play really well, he didn't have to play that much.
No, that's true. That's true.
And when I was watching, I was irritated at the defense because you kept seeing problems. But that said, Given only had to make 2-3 saves, something like that. Maybe a few more at the end of the game there where it got frantic. But for the first 80 minutes or so, the defense, for all I wanted to complain, actually put up a good show.
I think, yeah. And I mean, you know, it's because Hutton is terrible, at least in my case, that I personally dislike Richard Dunn. So I'm not particularly inclined to give our defense a lot of credit. But, you know, they did at the start of this year, before we had a podcast and just started slating everyone. They played reasonably well. I think when they're up for it, they can be a reasonably stout back line. They're far from the best in the division, but they're also not absolutely ragged like some of the ones we've seen sort of to other clubs down at the bottom end of the table. And I think, I mean, that's part of the reason, especially when you consider that we have no interest in scoring goals. I think you could almost credit a lot of our, you know, genuinely positive place in the league table right now to, a solid-ish defense.
Yeah, I mean, we've allowed 17 goals this season. And you compare it to a team like Bolton, who's allowed 31.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And that's, I mean, okay, yeah, it's not great, but it's only 5 goals off the top of the league pace.
Oh, it could emphatically be worse. And I think we've seen with Villa, it's been worse. Like, we haven't been well and truly blown out like we were against Newcastle last year. I mean, Tottenham could have been that, but it wasn't. And so I guess if we're going to credit Richard Dunn and James Collins for Emmanuel Adebayor's bad finishing, you know, we might as well. I'm sure they'll take that.
Watching Adebayor, I couldn't help but think that was like a best case scenario Heskey. You get a couple of great goals and then you get a couple of just what the heck happens.
I don't know. I can't figure it out because he'll go on runs when he scores a lot. But I mean, there's got to be some reason he's played for like 4 clubs over the last 2 years. Like, he went from Arsenal, he went to City, and then when it became obvious he was never going to play at City, he got loaned out to Madrid, and now he's loaned out to Spurs. And I don't know. Yeah, I can't figure him out. But I mean, I guess if you consider a best case Heskey to be, you know, a big man who can actually control football and, you know, score.
Yeah.
I suppose.
I mean, yeah, it's kind of, it doesn't feel this way, but there's only one match in which we've given up more than 2 goals. And that was the City match. And I don't think anyone would fault Villa for giving up more than 2 goals to City.
Well, that's fair enough. Everyone gives up more than 2 goals to City, pretty much.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's just weird. I'm looking at this, and it doesn't connect with my brain. They've been that good.
Yeah, every time I look at the table, I mean, and we can talk about how it's a completely false position. Well, not completely false position, but it's a largely false position because we've had a totally cream puff schedule. And it's entirely possible that there's going to be a reckoning over the next month or so, and we could find ourselves, you know, down around the bottom. Although, you know, our mantra at this point is that there are so many clubs worse than Villa that it's impossible for us to really bottom out. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's entirely possible that we're being more pessimistic than necessary when you consider that, are we 8th or 9th, something like that. We're sort of hovering around the same place we finished last season.
Eighth, yeah, which is just shocking to me. But
because it doesn't feel like an eighth place team, right? Like, but it, I mean, you look at a table and think about the teams that are below us, and quite often I think, oh, those, they're better than us. Why are we above them? And this is where, you know, McLeish's tendency to grind out boring draws really sort of bears well for us, is because, I mean, those are points. Those are, drawing a game, as boring as it is, and as stupid as this seems to say, drawing a game is better than losing a game. And it's entirely possible that if we had, I don't know, I'd get crucified for saying this with Kirsten or Aaron on the podcast. And this up. If we'd had Martinez, if we'd hired Martinez, it's entirely possible we might be worse off. And by no means should anyone take that as an endorsement of McLeish or his tactics, because I don't like him very much, but I don't really like Martinez either.
Fair enough. One thing that struck a couple of weeks ago when I was last on this, I think we talked about the table, but one thing that really strikes me about the table this year is how it's totally opposite from last year. Because last year it seemed like we had like 16 teams that could have swapped places with one another. And this year we're in eighth place and the team above us has
Over the past. Yeah. Oh, there is a huge gulf in talent, in class, between, you know, the top six or so teams, and Newcastle is sort of the surprise in amongst the big spenders. But I mean, essentially the Premier League now is divided in two. And I mean, if you divide it in two, we're actually doing shockingly well. But I mean, again, a lot of that goes down to strength of schedule and all those sort of things that are going to even themselves out in the new year.
And I'd say if you put points aside, it's really divided into three, because there's two or three teams at the bottom this year that, you know, there's no reason to fear about relegation, because there's two or three teams that just, there's no way they're doing anything.
Well, that's the thing, is that if for all intents and purposes this year, there are only two relegation spots, because Blackburn has one of them sewn up.
Exactly. Yeah. Can you see Blackburn doing anything?
They're so terrible. Like, they're so, I mean, they're phenomenally entertaining to watch, because they're absolute idiots. Like, they're so poorly assembled. But and there's always goals in their games, which is great. They're a woeful team.
It's like watching why can't I think of the right word for it? The Monty Python sketch with all the idiots, where it's trying to be the idiot of the year. They don't call it idiot, they call it something else. Look, Aaron's online. We're going to add him.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Here, Aaron. Hold on a moment, podcast listeners. Hello there.
Howdy, gentlemen.
How are we?
Hey, look at that.
We've got a podcast crew now.
So, I know, it's true. It's a veritable mob.
That's it. We've got a full set now. This is perfect.
Yeah.
All righty.
So Robert and I have pretty much exhausted all of our observations about the Swansea match. So if you wanted to chip in with a few of your own,
I don't really have anything. I mean, it was as exciting as I think Villa are ever going to be on the road. So, that was nice, I guess. And they played well defensively. I thought the midfield was good, but other than that, nothing to really be that excited about.
It kind of was, I mean, and I guess, I think as we've said, is it was largely probably due to the, you know, circumstances outside of the match, sort of overwhelming the actual match, but it was a pretty drab game.
Yeah, it really was. Yeah, I mean, it was. Swansea was a lot less fun to watch than they usually are. The crowd was never really in the game. It was a game that when you ask me about it a month from now, I won't really have any recollection of it at all.
Yeah, well, and I feel like I obviously couldn't pull stats for it. But I'm assuming that they dominated absolutely dominated the possession. But I mean, I think as we all know, that's not McLeish's game.
Right. I think they had something like 70% of the possession. But you know, you can get away with having that sort of number when they don't really get any shots on goal. And Swansea just, they couldn't get anything going in the attack. They were very, very lacking in creativity. And, you know, I think Villa in the preventing Swansea from doing well aspect of things was actually quite good. It was the actually doing things themselves where it was lacking. And that was just execution, I think, more than tactics, honestly.
Yeah. Well, and the one other sort of major thing that Robert and I have been talking about is sort of the use of Darren Bent in McLeish's system and whether or not we would be better served benching Bent and playing Heskey in his sort of center forward role, just because he's a lot better at holding up play than Darren Bent is.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it a lot, but I think Darren Bent is totally wasted in this system, and I think Gabby is the perfect striker for this kind of system, and you know, he has enough speed and enough dribbling ability to be able to thrive when, you know, pretty much everything the team does is going to come on a counter. He's linked up pretty well with Bent a few times this season, so I'm not completely without hope. And, you know, I have to believe that Charleston Zogby is going to perform better at some point. But I just think Bent is an expensive luxury.
He's not really, I mean, he has linked up well with Gabby, but that was Gabby creating chances that pretty much, like, you or I could finish those.
Exactly.
I mean, it's not a 24 million pound skill that we've been seeing.
Right. I mean, Darren Bent has to get good service from the wings or good service from a sort of very attacking midfielder, and that's just not going to happen in the system. And I think that Martin O'Neill was obviously not as negative as McLeish is. He actually, you know, was trying to counterattack, whereas McLeish is just hoping that the opposition doesn't score. But in a system where you're sitting deep and you're kind of letting the opponent come to you, you know, Gabby is perfect in that system. And I think that, it shouldn't be surprising that he's been so much better this season. I think he's genuinely improved, but, you know, Julier's game just wasn't really Gabby's game. And a system that gives him a lot more space to run in is much more well suited to him. Bent is either great in a possession-based team with creativity coming from somewhere, or also in a pure counter-attacking system, and it just doesn't do either of those things at all.
I'd be intrigued. This is just my ignorance from not having watched long enough. Is there much precedent for a team's best striker coming in from one of the wings, as opposed to spending most of his time sitting in front of the goal?
Well, I mean, sure. It depends on a lot of... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, you first.
I was just going to say, I mean, there's different kinds of strikers. I mean, I'm loath to compare, you know, Gabriel Aguanlahor to Luis Suarez and David Villa, but those are two, you know, two excellent strikers who have trademark cutting in from the wing. And it's sort of, I don't know, I think it's a stylistic thing, and I'm not sure that Gabby's necessarily the same, you know, style of striker as Suarez or as Villa, but I mean, it's not like there's a precedent for that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's really the kind of thing where you have to be playing three strikers, and no matter what Alex McLeish wants to say about playing four forwards, I mean, we all know that he's never going to actually play three strikers. And it's sad because I actually think that
they'll be playing as
Gabby on the left, on the right, and the ball playing as strikers would actually be really fun to watch and would be really, really dangerous, and it would be tough for teams to deal with. And you know, it's another example of McLeish having a system that he wants to fit the players to, and you can't really do that when you don't have money to buy players.
No, and I think, I mean, we don't really have a whole lot of money. Lerner's priority is to cut the wage bill, and so, you know, there's not going to be any purchasing going on.
No, there's not.
Although,
it's gonna be,
you know,
the most boring transfer window.
I was going to say, speaking of the transfer window, and this is just the most awkward segue, but what do you think the chances are that Darren Bent returns to his former club, Sunderland, under their new manager, Martin O'Neill?
It would be hilarious.
What would his girlfriend think?
I mean, any number of reasons, really.
I doubt it, just because the split was so acrimonious.
You don't think the Sunderland fans would welcome him back, you know, despite the fact that they kind of hated him? You know, once he comes back, they realize, oh yeah, he's actually really pretty good.
He would be a pretty good way for them to avoid relegation, considering they don't have a striker.
Right. They have Bentner, so we've got that covered for him.
I think my statement pretty much stands.
Yeah. I think it would be very smart for them to do. I still think, for whatever reason, I mean, that Aston Villa still has a ton of cachet, and I think that him going back to Sunderland is going to nuke his England career. I honestly would not be at all surprised to see him leave. Probably more likely in the summer than in January. But if he does, I think he's going to go to one of the bigger clubs at that point, or a bigger club than Villa at least.
Sure. How about this? Do you think there's a better chance that Darren Bent leaves Aston Villa or that Martin O'Neill joins Sunderland?
I think there's a better chance Darren Bent leaves Aston Villa. I think there's a better chance that Stylian Petrov leaves Aston Villa than Martin O'Neill goes to Sunderland.
I genuinely don't know what job he's holding out for. Maybe he just hates management.
And
yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible.
I don't get why anyone would hire him after what he did to Villa last year. I mean, and I understand that people are notoriously quick to forget things like that, but dude left a week before the season. Why would you trust your team to someone that has shown they will do that?
A lot of people sided with Martin O'Neill in that situation. I mean, there's definitely a mentality of it's the investment mentality. I mean, it's, you know, it's Aston Villa spent way too much money on really marginal, crappy players for years and years and years and years, and it came back to bite them in the ass. And now that, you know, McLeish isn't being given $50 million a window to spend on players, Randy Lerner is a sack of crap and doesn't have any, you know, designs on ever competing for Europe again and all that sort of thing. I mean, so there are people out there that think Martin O'Neill was totally justified in leaving because he didn't get every penny to spend from the Milner sale. And, you know, I got in an argument with Alan Hinton about this on Twitter, who is a bona fide legend of English soccer, who, you know, who completely blames Aston Villa for Martin O'Neill leaving. I mean, there are people that actually believe this. And
I mean, like, I was listening to Five Live for the Manchester United League Cup games, and, you know, before the game, they were having Sandal on O'Neill to Sunderland and all that sort of stuff. And it's a very boys sort of mentality. Like, all these guys know Martin O'Neill. They've probably either been managed by him or played with him or any number of sort of those things. And so there's a lot of misconceptions. And I think a lot of times people will side with a manager in a manager versus management conflict. There was one particularly special pundit who said, and I think Chris Knee, notable blogger Chris Knee, called it as it was Pat Murphy, who I don't know, but apparently he's got a bit of a reputation. He basically came out and said that if O'Neill doesn't get the Sunderland job, it's because Villa has slandered his reputation, and apparently the reason he left is because he just wanted £7 or £8 million to buy Scott Parker, And, you know, mean old Randy Lerner wouldn't give it to him. And so he left, which is ridiculous on about 100 different levels. And it's, I mean, it's just, it's genuinely like, it's not even so much about leaving 7 days before the season started, which is, you know, unbelievably unprofessional. But to a certain degree, if there was a genuine grievance, you could overlook that. The problem is that we are still very much living with, you know, borderline catastrophic effects of buying mediocre players and paying them way over the odds.
I mean, Habib Bai is example 1A in that. It just, he was an O'Neal guy, correct?
He was, yeah.
Yeah. And so anyone that says, you know, it was Aston Villa's fault, it's like they gave him money and he got Habib Bai. So what more evidence do you need that he shouldn't have been given money?
I think in reality, it, you know, any manager that is going to get that much money over that long period of time is gonna make bad decisions. My bigger problem with O'Neal was that he kept making the same bad decisions, and he made them over and over, and, you know, they finished 6 3 years in a row, and they never really showed a whole lot of improvement. They never looked any more likely than the year before to actually make a run to the Champions League. And, you know, at a certain point, I think Randy Lerner is totally within his rights to say, hey, the club is still losing money on an operational standpoint. We need to kind of refocus and make another charge at this in a few years. And, you know, it's insane to me because the same people that bitch about people like Randy Lerner not being willing to invest in his club, despite the fact that he invested a ridiculous amount of money in his club, are the same people that bitch about clubs like Manchester City ruining football. I mean, you can't have it both ways. You know, you just can't. But I think, you know, people just like Martin O'Neill because he's smart and well-spoken and plays entertaining but very, very, very old-school English football. They like him, and they don't want to think he would ever do anything wrong.
Well, and I mean, if Sunderland do end up hiring O'Neill, the upshot of that is that he will almost certainly sell all their foreign players way under the odds, and so hopefully we pick up like Stefan Jan or something like that.
That would be nice. Yeah. The weird thing about Martin O'Neill is that he had just aversion to foreign players that was, I mean, just I think it was just more of a, I'm comfortable, I know these guys very well, and I don't want to put a ton of money into scouting. But sometimes he would just, you know, I mean, he absolutely adored Stylian Petrov. And I know that he, you know, had managed Petrov before, but he bought him from, I don't remember where, but he brought him to, you know, he did not buy him from Scotland. And so he would do stuff like that like John Carew is another example. I mean, he was playing for, was it Marseille before he came to Villa?
He was, yeah. He was playing in the Champions League for some reason. John Carew was in the Champions League.
Right. Well, France is the reason. But, I mean, it was just so weird because there would be such obvious solutions to the problems outside of England and Scotland. And it would be like, nope, Richard Dunn. We're paying, you know, £8 million for Richard Dunn. But, you know, they would go to France to get strikers, where strikers are actually overpriced. It's very weird transfer strategy that wee little man had.
Well, I mean, I guess thank goodness we now have a manager with a much more progressive transfer policy. So,
well, he did. I mean, you know, he did buy John Bissouzour and Nikola Zidic and what's the other guy?
And look how well they turned out.
Right, exactly. I mean, the thing is, it's like he looks for good players, or he looks outside of the UK for players, but they all suck. So
alrighty. So what about this weekend's match? You all looking forward to it?
No.
Well, I mean, essentially, we're screwed. We're so very desperately screwed. I mean, for a number of reasons, not least of which is because United effectively suffered a couple of bad beats over the last week or so. I mean, they drew a game to Newcastle that they really should have won, even though I particularly thought that the penalty decision, however wrong it was absolutely delightful. And then they went out of the Carling Cup today to Crystal Palace, and even if they were playing their, you know, under 14s or whatever they rolled out with, that will still be a game that Alex Ferguson is not pleased with losing. So I would imagine sort of hell hath no fury like a Scotsman scorn, and we're going to be on the end of an absolute beatdown. So, I mean, if I was to put a score on it,
yeah,
I'm reluctant to do that, but it'll be up there.
I think especially, too, it could be very ugly because it's going to be at Villa Park. People are not especially happy with McLeish anyway. You know that he is not going to play any sort of aggressive style against Manchester United. And it's just so frustrating because you think back to how hopeful everyone was after the Manchester United game last year at Villa Park. And even though the season really, you know, took a turn for the worse pretty shortly after that, I think everybody felt really good about the team at that point. And this year it's just going to be, it's going to be brutal. It's going to be terrible to watch. And the worst thing about it is that I think McLeish might have learned his lesson in the Tottenham game about somehow playing more defensively after going behind. And, you know, United is the only team that I think you could actually justify doing that against, you know, maybe City as well. It's just going to be, it's going to be terrible. I'm really not looking forward to watching it. I'm hoping that my subconscious tricks me into spoiling the score before I have a chance to watch the replay, and I can spare myself.
I mean, I genuinely think, and I think this is part of the reason we had such a good result against United sort of in the corresponding fixture last year that you're talking about. I think Houllier had the confidence in his players to say, you know, we're at home, we're going to have the sort of the bravado to go out and at least give them a game. But I don't think McLeish has the confidence, and I don't think we have the squad to sort of repeat that effort. Like, I think that, I mean, you never want to go into a home game scared, but I get the impression that McLeish will go in treating it like an away match. And I mean, if you judge on the way the season is going so far at other, you know, with other clubs, I don't think we're too early in the year to start hearing, you know, chanting for his head.
I'm intrigued by what Aaron said, that, you know, we went into last year's game and we had so much hope coming out of Manchester United, but we were only at that point last year 3 points ahead of where we are this year, albeit in one fewer match. But it wasn't like Villa were doing great going into the Manchester United game. And so the optimism that came from that came from sort of the surprise of holding with Manchester at home. But, you know, Gareth brings up the point that we're probably not going to be able to do that this year. But what if we do? What happens if they do keep up with Manchester at home? Do we come out of that with the same optimism we had last year?
I think it depends entirely on how they do it. You know, I think that one of the things about the game last year was that, you know, they really should have won that game. And it was just down to the kids kind of, I think, not really being able to keep their composure towards the end of the game. But I think the difference is that, you know, Villa went out and tried to get something out of the game. They didn't hope to keep from losing something from the game. And, you know, I just don't see that happening. And I think the big difference between, the team is in a better position this year in terms of the table than they were going into that game last year. But there were a lot of reasons, I think, that you could look and say, you know, these are reasons that you can very concretely connect to why this team has been underperforming. I mean, Martin O'Neill leaving a week before the season, the man. Managers are snuggy, not really wrapping up until the end of the season, not joining the club until I think well into September. Maybe might have even been October by the time he was really in charge. And then there were all those injuries. And, you know, there were just there were valid reasons for it. And this year, there just hasn't been. You know, McLeish had all summer. He had some money, not a lot, but some money to get some players. He's had ample time to get them playing the style that he wants to play. The style that he wants to play is more well suited to his personnel than maybe what Julio was trying to do, was trying to play a high defensive line with Richard Dunn and James Collins. You know, this is basically as good a situation that Leach could have as a first year manager, and we're barely better than a team that was, you know, for all intents and purposes, totally on fire at the time they played United, and not on fire in a good way. I mean, like, actually in flames, you know, being consumed by fire. And, you know, McLeish doesn't really have that excuse. And it's you know what? Some of it is probably just a personal subjective bias where I don't like Alex McLeish and I did like Gerard Houllier. I'm sure that comes into it. But when we're talking about how you feel going into a game, that's a big part of it, I think.
I think it's still eminently possible that we come away with a draw from this match, like we did from the last one. But if in the event that we do, it will be a very different kind of draw. It will likely be a 0-0. And, you know, that's not the worst thing. You know, I'll be relatively glad, if a bit frustrated that I just spent 90 minutes watching that. But, really.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that, you know, at this point, I want Villa to play just well enough to avoid relegation, and I don't feel bad saying that, because unless Alex McLeish has something in his bag of tricks where he's going to pull it out and surprise me, you know, and I think it was him buying Alan Hutton that really sealed the deal, where before it was like, okay, he's doing what he has to do to keep things going. Let's see what he does when he has a little bit of money to spend in January. And, you know, he spent it on Alan Hutton. That was his idea of a player he wanted on his team. So now, you know, I don't really wish him success, and I feel terrible saying that. But if he's going to be playing the style of football, I don't, you know, I want to enjoy watching Aston Villa play. You know, I'm sure there are people that would call me a bad fan and say I'm an idiot and that I have to back the manager and whatever, but I don't, you know, people watch sports for different reasons. I watch it to be entertained, and Bastonville is not very entertaining right now.
You watch sports to be entertained, and yet you're a Seattle Mariners fan as well. You're not doing a great job there.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's true. I know how to pick them. But I think the frustrating thing is that I did actually, in a way, get to pick Aston Villa. I didn't get to pick the Mariners, the Seahawks, or the Sounders, although I would have picked the Sounders if I had been able to. But, you know, Aston Villa, I had a chance to pick a team that wasn't going to kill my soul, and I didn't. And it's too late now.
I guess the one thing that sort of we're glossing over that's left unsaid is that Alex McLeish is not necessarily the transition manager we would hope he would be, and it's entirely possible that we're, you know, if it's not an outright catastrophic failure, and of course even worse than rooting for the bare minimum is rooting for worse than that, but if it's not a catastrophic failure, it's entirely possible that we're looking at 2-4 years of McLeish. So we've got that to look forward
to. God. Exactly. And that's the thing. Until he starts playing football that is entertaining to watch, and until he stops doing stupid things on the transfer market, I'm not going to be upset when we win. I'm not going to, because there's nothing to gain from it. I mean, it's not like they get a higher draft pick if they finish lower in the table. It's not going to be as exciting as it is when I like the style my team plays, you know, and that's a bummer. That's
well, and there's like a compromise or, you know, a deal we have to make. And that, I mean, the management, Lerner and Faulkner and all of them would go one way while I would go another. And it's sort of the difference between being sort of a mediocre club, like a mid-table club that's boring, or an absolute, like, catastrophe team that just barely avoids relegation, but at least has the decency to be interesting for a whole season. And I would very much prefer that, even though I'm sure that's not exactly what, if you've made a substantial investment in a football club, I don't think that's what you're looking for.
Are you thinking of Blackpool last year?
I'm almost thinking of us last year, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Terrifying, but also interesting.
Because, I mean, you're missing that stipulation, narrowly avoided relegation, not narrowly was relegated.
Okay, yeah.
Right. Which is, you know, when you, like you said, Gareth, when you have that much money invested in something and you stand to lose something like £40 million, if you're relegated, it's not worth the risk. And that's why I have a hard time being too angry at Lerner about it, especially since, you know, by all intents or by all appearances, his first choice was Roberto Martinez. You know, I get why McLeish is here. I just wish he wasn't.
Do you think if, you know, sort of hoping beyond hope, if Martinez, for whatever reason, ends up leaving Wigan, do you think the switch gets made, or do you think we're pretty much Lerner has picked his horse?
I think Lerner has picked his horse. I think he's a very stubborn man. I will say that. And I think that... if he has a detriment as a chairman, that would be it, is that he is going to stick by the decisions he made until he really doesn't have another option.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's, you say it all when you realize that he also owns the Cleveland Browns and as such has a commitment to bland mediocrity.
Right, yeah.
The man is busy overpaying Peyton Hillis, so, you know, he doesn't have money for we football fans.
So I guess as the notable optimist, Robert, do you have, I mean, for this United game, do you have anything better than, you know, doomsday?
I think our only hope is if Gabby comes in motivated. I could see him. He's been such a force this season all by himself that I could see him getting a brace on his own by some miracle of God. And us holding on and keeping United, like you and I talked about earlier, you know, I can see us holding almost any team in the table to two or fewer goals. So if Gabby can work a miracle, I think we can get a draw. Otherwise, I think we're screwed.
Yeah, and I mean, especially if the Twins play out wide, or if they're the fullbacks, which they may be because Villa isn't much of a threat. I mean, those kids are super, super talented, and they're going to be fantastic players, but, oh my God, they're a train wreck right now. They make such stupid mistakes. And Gabby, I think, is actually to the point in his career where he's smart enough, and that sounds so weird to say, but he's smart enough to take advantage of you know, players making really stupid mistakes. So, yeah, I mean, I could see that happening.
Well, yeah, I think if Johnny Evans starts, that's guaranteed at least one penalty for us. So, right. I mean, Bent will get his goal that he's been searching for a couple of weeks now, and you know, it's not completely out of the realms of possibility that we will score a goal, and it's also not completely out of the realms of possibility that we hold United to a goal, or, you know, dare I say less, but I don't think any of that's going to happen, is it?
No. Let's see. What do we lose? 3-0, 3-1. God.
I'm thinking like 3-1.
I think if we'd faced United before the City match, where Alex Ferguson was still running his goal machine, we would have gotten absolutely just destroyed. Like, you know, they would have scored 5 or 6. But since he seems a lot less interested in blowing teams out of the water, I'd say 3-1.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, too, is they had a game today where they played mostly kids. So that incentive to rest Wayne Rooney or Chicharito or, you know, Nani or their actual first-choice players, that incentive just isn't there. And that means we're likely to see their best team. And their best team is, you know, United's problem, I think, this year is less about their top-tier players and more about their second-tier players and third-tier players. Their best team is still one of the probably five best teams in the world. So,
well, I think if United can be beat anywhere, it's genuinely pretty easy to win the battle in midfield, except when you're Aston Villa and you don't win any battles in midfield. So,
right.
Like, even that would be the one angle that we could get them at, and that's not going to happen. And I think, you know, it has nothing to do – this match for United has nothing to do with us, and it has a whole lot more about making a statement of intent that, hey, we can still win the title. And if that's what they want to do and they bring out, like, their top 11, we're going to get absolutely hammered.
Yeah.
Of course, then again, if they bring out their top 11, we won't see Ashley Young. So, you know.
Right, and I have a feeling that Ashley Young wants to start this game. I mean,
Yeah, I have a feeling he wants to start this game, he wants to score, and he wants to do that awful thing where he points at his name, as if we don't know who he is.
He has said that he wouldn't celebrate, but he's also a douchebag, so, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it past him in the heat of the moment to, you know, be a dick.
Right, and I think it depends, too, on what sort of reaction he gets. I mean, I hope the fans are appreciative of him. As much of a douchebag as I think he is, I don't really have any problem with it, the way he left. I don't have a problem with him wanting to leave. And you know, I never thought he wasn't playing hard. I just think he had kind of lost the will to care, which I can certainly understand.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if I was in his shoes, if I was, you know, clearly the most talented player on a team that was going nowhere, I would have stopped caring years ago.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's, in a way, it is good to see him actually living up to his potential, which is weird to say, because I wish he would have done it here, but,
you know. You know, that's the same sort of thing that we can say about Milner now that he's actually starting games for City, is because you can feel a bit, you're right to feel a bit aggrieved if he leaves your club and then he's not even good enough to start at the club he goes to. But, I mean, both of them are, you know, they're playing well and they're starting off. And so, you honestly kind of have to feel that upgrade was required, and you don't take the same amount of schadenfreude that Robert and I were taking earlier about Stuart Downing being so absolutely rubbish.
Yeah, I love that. That makes me very happy, because he was a total dick about the way he left. And he, you know, there was no real indication of it until about a week before the season. And yeah, so I want him to be terrible and never play for England again. But Ashley Young, I want to do well, so.
All right. Well, I think we've pretty much covered everything. Can anyone else think of anything else that we need to go over?
Well, there is that rumor about the Portuguese striker, but I think it's BS. So I'm not buying it, just because where's the money going to come from?
Well, yeah, and it genuinely sounds like some enterprising transfer journalist. And I mean, it kind of makes sense. If you have to cobble together a transfer rumors column every day, you're just going to search Wikipedia for a bit. So.
And eventually you'll find us buying that terrifying picture of Andy Marshall.
Yeah, I mean, this is... Yeah. I think that the sad thing about this particular transfer rumor is that this is the caliber of player Villa is now being fake linked to. Like, in the summer it was like, you know, Diego who was the other one? The Real Madrid, Philippe Coutinho, players like that. And now it's like a Portuguese guy who can't even, you know, really get in the first team with Sporting that we're being connected to, who's like 25 years old. It's like, oh, that's sad. That's kind of a downgrade.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I can't see, you know, Villa making any splash, and it's going to be one of those lower caliber players, which is just so upsetting.
Yeah, if it were a midfielder, I would be a little happier, because we don't need strikers. We really
exactly
don't.
And it's what makes me kind of want to believe that we could get rid of Darren Bent, is the idea that if we did that, then maybe we'd have money to spend and we could make a splash.
Yeah, yeah, it would be nice, but I just don't. I think it won't happen, not for the right reasons, but for totally the wrong reasons, and that's really, really annoying.
You think what won't happen?
I don't think Darren Bent won't be sold, not because the people in charge of the team think it's right to keep him, but because they're terrified of what would happen if they sold him. And that's just, sure. It's insane.
You mean the backlash of hiring McLeish in a season and then dropping the 23 million pound man?
Right, exactly. I mean, people had an aneurysm when Gary Gardner was loaned out for a month. I mean, can you imagine what would happen if they sold Darren Bent? And, you know, unless they replaced him with someone totally awesome 5 minutes later, they would probably burn down Bonnymore Heath, you know, and that's, I understand that from Lerner's standpoint, but I also, it bums me out.
Yeah. Gareth and I touched on this at the very beginning, that, you know, it's a matter of, do you get the manager to fit the personnel, or do you get the personnel to fit the manager? And I imagine if you ask most Villa fans right now, most of them would say, keep Bent, get rid of McLeish, and find someone that can make Bent work again. But, I think you're right. People would burn the place down if we got rid of Bent.
Right, and I think it would be reflective anger from, you know, the hiring of McLeish. I think you get a manager that has a style that you like, that is also willing to adapt it to the players you have until he gets his players in. And, you know, McLeish has not done that at all, because we're not playing a style that fits our players. If I felt like he was playing this way because he had to, it would be less frustrating, but he's playing this way because this is the way he likes to play, and that sucks.
Yeah, it makes for some boring and depressing football to watch. But that said, I can't think of a better alternative right now. And maybe that's just because we've hired McLeish, and, you know, he's here to stay, at least for a while. And it's hard for me to see Villa giving up in the middle of it right now, so.
Yeah, and I think firing him at this point would probably be a disaster, unless you know who you're going to replace him with, so. I think we're stuck with him at least through the end of the year, and probably for another 2 or 3.
You mean we can't replace him with Gary McAllister?
Well, we probably could, but...
Is he still around? No, he left.
No, he's gone. He's gone.
Oh, well, I'm sure he'd be happy to come back.
I'm sure he would. But we could replace him with Kevin McDonald, which would be nice.
I hear Martin O'Neill's available.
No, he's at Sunderland now.
Or will be by the time anyone gets to listen to this. Good heavens.
Exactly.
Oh, alrighty. Well, have you got anything else you can think of?
I think we've all depressed ourselves and everyone else enough tonight.
Well, alright. Well, Gareth had to drop out because he had to go off to his concert thing. So, Gareth was with us for the beginning. Aaron got to join us here in the middle. Thanks for coming in. Even if you could only get for the latter half, we were glad to have you.
I was glad to be here.
I'm glad to finally have been on a podcast with you, and
I know.
It's lovely.
It is. It's very nice. It's very nice. And
someday, perhaps, we'll get the whole crew.
That would be very nice. We could just all talk at once. It would be awesome. It would just be a cacophony of depression.
Oh, it'd be like listening to so many Seattle bands.
Exactly. It would be the vocal version of that.
how fitting. Well, fantastic. Well, thanks for tuning in to yet another episode of the 7500 to Holt podcast. We'll be back sometime next week. You've heard Gareth Simpson, Aaron Campo, and I'm Robert Lintott, and have a fantastic day.